Dr. Jones?
Yeah.
Yes?
Indy, look.
Oh, another lost episode, Shorty. Junior, some things are better off lost.
I didn't know whether I should explain or just leave it as it is. But duh, it is 2019, not 2018. And as the Indiana Jones characters just pointed out, this episode is one that I consider lost. It was made last year, last December, for release that year, and I had meant to record this story that day, and I didn't do it. I think I just ran out of time. But I did record the episode, and here we are at the end of 2019. And in the 12 months since then, I had never recorded the story. I realized if I was going to get the episode out, I had to do it now. I couldn't wait for an optimal time. And so here I am at the family cabin, the last time I'm going to be here this year. I just sat down and I recorded the whole story. And there are a couple of parts that I guess will have to be revised because I don't have the other stories in front of me and I didn't know what to do. I had a draft of the story, which I'm assuming was the final draft of the story, but it's hard to know because this isn't even the same laptop that the story was on last year. And I've lost stuff in between the craptop crapping out on me. That's not irony, is it? That's just par for the course. And getting this. And so what you're about to hear is the best I could do up in the mountains with no internet. And the sound quality is not optimal. I went somewhere small that would cut down on all of the echoing that I can hear right now because it's got a wood ceiling and wood walls and wood echoes. If you drop something anywhere in the cabin, you hear it everywhere in the cabin. And that includes sitting on the toilet. And then there's the smoke alarm. I guess the battery needs to be changed in the smoke alarm, or by design, it's supposed to beep intermittently. I'd say it beeps every 30 seconds or 1 minute. And I started recording last night and I thought, oh, this is not going to work. And then I said to myself, no, I have to do this. And just every time that smoke alarm beeps, I will redo that line. And then in editing, no one will ever know that it was going off constantly. And I just sat down to start editing the story because I have to do it right now to get it out. And there are times when I guess I was focused on the reading and I didn't hear the beep. And so you will hear the beep. And that's it. I felt like having a 90% satisfactory reading of the story on time,
a year late,
is better than a 100% satisfactory reading of the story, but not making it in time for Christmas. We'll see what I end up doing after this episode's released, but I hope that you appreciate that I put something out there, and we'll keep in mind that maybe it's not the best quality. And as for the rest of the episode, it was recorded on the streets of Chicago, and it shows. It was difficult to edit. I cut out as much honking and other people on the sidewalk talking and sirens and me sniffling because it was so cold as I could. But yeah, it's when we used to do the That Gets My Goat on the Go episodes. They always had terrible quality audio. And this is a throwback to those. Happy holidays, and good luck.
Lately, I've been thinking, I want you to be happier. I want you to be happier. Hello there. This is Rish Outfield, and this is the Christmas episode of the Rish Outcast. And I am transmitting to you, I wanted to say live. For me, it's live. For you, it is so edited and taped and saved and resaved that it never was live to begin with. But me, I'm speaking to you live in the Windy City of Chicago. And it's cold. But it's that kind of cold that reminds you that you have a pulse. That reminds you that there's still blood going through your veins. And I dig it. I was in my room. I'm staying at the Inn of Chicago. And I was in my room and I edited a podcast. And I was trying to decide what to do. Whether I should just stay there or come out and be cold. Because I have about an hour to kill. And I thought, okay, I will take a walk. I will take in some of this culture, this new city that I'll probably never get to see again. And, well, I made it. I crossed the street. And then I turned around and I said, nope, I'm going to go get my recorder and I'm going to turn this walk into an episode. But what will my Christmas episode be? I had considered not even doing a Christmas episode because we're getting closer. We're getting closer to the holiday and I don't know if I'm going to have time. And of course, I can always do an episode like I'm doing right now. You know, I do them when I'm driving because you're not going anywhere. You're out and about, you might as well, right? But the story part, that's the hard thing. And I thought, you know, do I want to do a story? There was a story I was going to do, and part of it takes place, it's a Christmas story, and part of it takes place at Toys R Us, which is gone now. So I thought this is a good year to put that out because Toys R Us is gone. But I looked on my crap top and the version that I have there is incomplete. It's not in any condition where I could do it. My plan had been to sit down and record that story from my hotel room. And I figured, well, depending on how long it takes me to record, I will know how long it's going to be to edit. I figured I'd do all the voices myself and maybe no vocal effects, that kind of stuff. But if it turned out to be too much work, then I wouldn't have a Christmas episode this year. I've got other episodes that can go in its place. And so we'd save it for next year. No one would be the wiser except me. Ooh, I just got a weird look. People think that I'm talking to myself. Whoops. It's okay, I should have one of those things around your ear. Bluetooth, that's what it is. But oh well. My thought was, you know, if I failed, then maybe I could put it out next year and only I would know that I had failed. But as I said, that story is not, the version that I have on my laptop is not even the complete story. It is partially typed up from my notebook, I think. I don't know, there may not be a complete version of the story anywhere. And it's too bad, because I would have liked to have talked about Toys R Us and how this is the first Christmas without a Toys R Us. Then my second thought was, well, I wrote a Ben Parks Christmas story last year that I thought, well, I'll use for my Christmas episode 2017, and I never did. I don't know that I even typed it up. And when I did type it up, I didn't feel like it was ready to go. So I didn't do it last year. But I thought, well, I've got that on my laptop. Maybe that can be my Christmas episode. And that's what I'm going to do. Anyhow, I'm in it. Now, I'm going to do it. I don't know that this is optimal to do another Ben Parks story so close to the last Ben Parks story. But what can you do? This one is called Choice of a Sidekick. Now, the file that I opened today to glance at before I started recording this had two options for titles. A Sidekick's Holiday, that was the original title, A Sidekick's Holiday. And I like that way better than Choice of a Sidekick, because it sounds like a Christmas title. But when you hear the story, holidays are incidental to the story. It's not necessarily a Christmas story. Well, it's not even as Christmassy a story as Die Hard. I guess it's as Christmassy as Lethal Weapon. But there we go. I didn't want to waste this trip around the lovely city of Chicago. And you know what? It is lovely. I haven't been to a lot of big cities, but it's definitely cleaner and more sightsee, much more stuff to see than LA. And yeah, the people honking notwithstanding, everybody's been really nice. I don't know, I feel like maybe it's the holidays. Everybody's just a little smileier and decent. But let me go ahead and run that story. And I'll see you on the other side, and maybe we can talk a tiny bit about it. Maybe not.
Choice of a Sidekick by Rish Outfield. Arizona doesn't get snow very often, but it was getting quite cold at the San Domingo Orphanage for Boys, and that meant Christmas was coming. For little Benny Parks, it was a time of hope and happy memories, although maybe not so much this year.
Oh, no te llores, mijo. El vaquero liviano ya viene.
Ben's tears stopped. Had he understood right?
In English, hermana, please?
The nun frowned. Her English was better than a lot of the sisters at the orphanage, and her voice was pretty in either language. But she didn't seem to know that.
Soon is coming Delin Ryder, Senor Cook.
That's what Ben thought she said.
Already? Wasn't he just here in...
He tried to recall. It had been March. Not a terribly short time, but not even long in kid time.
What happened to Devon Darkey?
Who? Ben blinked in surprise. Devon Stanley, the lucky boy the writer had picked for his last sidekick, the envy of everyone, even the Moncas.
The boy Senor Cook took last.
Oh, hermana Teresa said, and her eyes went elsewhere.
Estoy segura que se fue a otras cosas.
She may have said she was sure he had gone on to other things, but it sounded like a lie to Ben. He knew it was wrong to tell lies, sure, but he understood why a lie was preferable to the truth in some cases. Devon Darkey had been a handsome boy, the only blonde 11-year-old at the orphanage, and he lived on a cattle ranch with his uncle before coming here, so he had been a natural choice. That was always the real question whenever the lean rider came to pick a new boy. What would he look for? What would he notice? What set you apart from the other boys? Three questions, but really one. And it wasn't an easy question to answer. Hector Sagano was the fastest boy there. He could run like a jackrabbit. Salazar Pilar was the smartest, but his eyesight was so bad it sometimes seemed like he couldn't see at all. Another little boy had no legs, so that made him pretty special, but it wasn't exactly the kind of special a gunslinger would look for. But Ben, what did he have? He spoke pretty good Spanish for not having known a word when he first came there, and he could read and write and knew math and geography. But he was small and timid and had never shot a gun or skinned a jackrabbit or even knew how to tie a good knot. More than anything, he wanted to be a sidekick. More even than getting adopted by some rancher or well-to-do family. After all, with adoption, you didn't know what you were going to get. With Jerome Cook, you knew exactly what you were in for. A life of adventure, dangerous missions, exciting travel, narrow escapes, reward monies, and the chance to help people in need. Ben had read the dime novels and pulp magazines about the Lean Rider's exploits, as told to Sidney Rembrandt, and would often read them aloud to the other boys, sometimes even managing to translate the gist for the Mexican kids. There was one story, The Lean Rider and the Thirst for Justice, that told about little Jerome Cook living at San Domingo's after his mother died of consumption, and how the kind priests and teachers had instilled in him a belief in fairness and loyalty. Ben couldn't help but suspect that that part was fictional, and how he vowed, after being adopted by a Texas marshal, that he'd always remember the lesson San Domingo taught him, and come back someday to pay the place back. And he did. Every time he wanted another helper, a sidekick to train and accompany him on his missions. There was even a wall right outside the orphanage chapel with the names of those lucky few, chosen for a life of action in the American West. It was something of a foolish aspiration, as the chances of being picked seemed less likely than getting bit by a diamondback while at the same time getting struck by lightning. It was far more probable that some family would come along and scoop Ben up, make him one of their own, offer him a more ordinary happy ending. He didn't dream of that, though. He would make a great sidekick. He'd find a way. Ben's two best friends at the orphanage were Eugenio and Tomas, two Mexican boys who slept in the same row in the dormitorio with him. Eugenio was 9 and ran toward Chubby. He had been at the place for 4 years, but you'd never know it by talking to him. He was almost constantly smiling, a cheerful optimist, prone to laugh, even when a joke wasn't that funny. He spoke both English and Spanish perfectly, and had taken it upon himself to get Ben up to speed. Ben had been at San Domingo's for nearly 2 years, and had more difficulty with languages and a positive attitude than Eugenio did. But he was coping excellently compared to Tomas, who was a year younger than Ben and Eugenio, and an emotional wreck. He hardly ever spoke, usually kept to himself, and would never use English, even though it was clear to Ben that he understood it. Something had happened to Tomas before he came to the orphanage, and it had broken his will. He'd often stare out the windows, or simply at a wall, seeing who knew what, sometimes silently weeping. He was timid in classes, too, often doing nothing more than nodding when called upon by the monjas, and once or twice, simply bursting into tears and sitting back down. A lot of the boys mocked him for this, calling him Tom Ass or El Llorón. But Ben couldn't do that. He remembered how he felt when he first came here, mourning his Aunt Tina and still reeling from his rejection by Cousin Chris. Ben had been taunted and pushed around for a couple of months before he realized that what made him a target was his, not that he'd recognized the word at 7, vulnerability. He steeled himself, changed his attitude little by little, and started to find things to like about the place, positives here and there, until one day he was throwing stones and playing stickball with the same boys he'd been so afraid of. He didn't know how he did it, in retrospect, and everything he tried with Tomas had little result. But he and Eugenio kept trying, always doing things as a trio instead of just leaving Tomas alone to be miserable or picked on. It wasn't easy. There was plenty to hate at San Domingo. The days were long. The work was hard. Half the bookbinding in Arizona Territory was done by the boys, and all of the rebinding. The teachers were strict, the priests often cold, and there were bad eggs among the boys. The baddest of these was easily Brock Lusk. He was 13, nearly 6 feet tall, and if there can be actual evil in an orphan boy, and Ben Parks would have sworn on a Bible there could be, he was evil. He wasn't just cruel or an opportunist looking for weak spots. He seemed to delight in generating fear among the other boys, feeding on tears the way a murciélago did on blood. Brock wasn't dumb, like some of the other bullies were, or frustrated with his situation. A lot of the boys who struck out at others were compensating for their own insecurities and fears, or was bullied by others and was merely passing it along. This was where most shoves, kicks, and taunts came from. No, there seemed to be something broken inside Brock Lusk, and he got pleasure out of breaking others. He'd tried 4 times with Ben Parks, tripping him as they were heading outside for exercise, getting him muddy from knees to sleeves, giving him what he called a tit twister, until he howled unexpectedly, interrupting Padre Puente's ceremony, hitting Ben in the base of the spine with a rock in the south field, then standing there proudly, not even trying to hide it, as though he'd be praised by the staff instead of thrashed. And, most recently, Brock Lusk had broken in on Ben in one of the privies, urinated on him, and then closed him into the outhouse, and jammed the door shut so that Ben had to be let out by the next boy to come along, who had been Jesus Chatwin, a poor stutterer who got more than his own share of torment by the nasty boys. Ben had tried to go to Hermana Ranquewe after the nipple incident, but she had berated him for weakness and constant complaining, even though it was the first time he'd spoken to her. She had told him, in razor-pitched Spanish, that every boy there had to manage himself and his affairs, and she had no time to manage them for him. ¿Qué hacen con un caballo que se quiebra su pierna? She asked. What do you do with a horse that injures its leg? Do you take time away from all the other horses tending to the hurt one? No, there's no time for that. What do you do with that horse?
¿Qué se hace con este caballo?
She had actually wanted an answer. And this had hurt Ben more than Lusk's persecution, especially having to say, "They shoot the horse," in trying not to cry Espanol. Speaking of horses, there was a corral on the south side of the orphanage compound. About a dozen, they were there to transport the staff, drag a plow in the field, or pull a wagon into town every other week. The boys could volunteer to care for the horses, and Ben and Eugenio had signed up as soon as they were old enough. They'd signed Tomas up, too, even though he was small and, big surprise, terrified of the 10 mares and 2 burros. It was their job, on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays anyway, to change the trough water, refill the hay, and muck out the stalls. If they wanted to, and they did, they could brush the horses' manes and tails, cleaning their legs or undersides if they got dirty. It was 90 minutes a day, and the boys looked forward to it. Well, Eugenio and Ben did. Tomas was afraid of getting stepped on or kicked. But he would go near the 2 burros and tended to them quietly and gently. Ben watched him one time, patting the animals, smiling and muttering to them, and thought it was good for him. Whatever had happened to Tomas was like falling into a deep, deep hole, and there was a lot more climbing left to do before he'd see the sun. Ben and Eugenio had taken to, when their regular work was done, riding the horses, just there in their corrals, but it was something. Ben had the imagination to pretend he was on the plains, the horse's hooves pounding beneath him, the wind whooshing through his hair. Sometimes he was a man, a sheriff or a bounty hunter, on his way to bring justice to a frontier town. Most of the time, though, he was the lean rider's junior partner, a gun on his hip and his own night-black stallion carrying him into danger. He'd be on his way to rescuing a kidnapped princess, or heading to the Albuquerque train station before the outlaws could get there, or tracking down the Comanche raiders that slaughtered a wagon train. His boss and friend, Jerome Cook, was going around the left while he went right. The lean rider counted on him, needed him, loved him. Once or twice, Ben had helped Tomas astride one of the burros, hoping he'd get a similar thrill from the experience. He'd cried the first time and wanted off, but the second time, he'd hugged the big gray animal around the neck, rocking gently in a way that warmed Ben's heart. Eugenio tried to get the boy to try it with one of the mares, but Tomas was skittish and only relented when Ben got on first. The two of them sitting bareback on a mighty steed with only 4 feet square to gallop in. Tomas had enjoyed this, and the next time was persuaded to get atop the brown mare Eugenio called Morado by himself. He'd only stayed on a minute, but he hadn't cried, and he hadn't fallen. Unfortunately, that was not the case the next time. As cruel fate would have it, Brock Lusk happened to have been rolling cigarettes out by the outhouses at the time. No one knew where he got the tobacco, but it was rumored the paper was torn out of Bible pages from the binding house. Apparently, he'd peeked in, saw the boys, and slammed a board against the side of the barn with such force that all the equines had jumped, jerked, or tried to bolt. Poor Tomas had been astride Morado, and in 1 second had been bucked right off. The boy flew back against the stall and onto the dusty, hay-strewn ground. Ben moved as fast as he could, grabbing Tomas and yanking him away from the stall, where he might be trampled by one of the mares. But Tomas let out a chilling shriek when Ben moved him, and Eugenio was sure that meant, along with the way he was holding it, that Tomas had broken his arm. Eugenio had gone outside, where he'd seen Brock smoking and smirking, and had a brief argument with Benny about whether they should take Tomas to see the now Madre Ranquewe, who was head of the administration and the closest thing they had to an on-site nurse. Eugenio felt it would be best for Tomas to go see her alone, so no one else might get in trouble. But Tomas didn't seem capable of walking in a straight line, let alone to the woman's office. In the end, Ben went with the injured boy, while Eugenio stayed behind and finished with the horses, which meant nothing more than making sure the corral doors were secured and locked. Ben and Tomas walked in while Ranquewe was meeting two other nuns, Hermanas Little and Teresa. Tomas had mewled pitifully all walk over, but now, interestingly, he had calmed and, in a small but audible voice, explained that he had tripped and hurt his arm.
"Where was this?" asked the head nun.
"The horse house," Tomas said, sniffling, but still calm.
"Why were you out in the..."
began the big woman, her face already starting to redden.
"Tomas and Benny take care of the animals,"
interrupted Hermana Teresa. Ben was surprised she knew that, but she had always been one of the good ones. Ben was asked to leave the room while Tomas was examined, and he caught a grateful look from his friend as he was escorted out. Tomas's arm, it was decided, was merely sprained. He got to wear what looked like a lady's scarf slung around his arm for a few days. He had not disclosed that he'd been astride a horse when he'd received his injury, or that Brock Lusk had had anything to do with it. Eugenio, it turned out, got it worst of all, having a personal visit from the bully who wanted to know what had happened to the crybaby, then smacked Genio in the stomach with the board he'd been hefting as an incentive not to squeal. Or maybe he'd seen Ben and Tomas leave and was taking out his frustration about that on the remaining boy. Only Ben had told the real story when Hermana Teresa took him aside to question him. She was an almost pretty, motherly woman that many of the boys developed a crush on over the years, Ben included. She had a scary-looking divot in their temple that Ben had long been curious about, but would never dare mention to her. When she pressed him on the details of Tomas's injury, Ben solemnly mentioned Brock Rusk, out rolling cigarettes by the barn and scaring the horses so Tomas was hurt. He failed to mention that the boy had fallen from horseback, since it was less important than that he'd fallen. When he found out that Tomas hadn't told the full story, he wondered if he had done the right thing. Tomas, however, was sure that Ben hadn't. He considered it a betrayal somehow, and was sure that more punishment was coming from Brock Lusk, who would never believe Tomas had not named him as the culprit. Ben tried to explain that they hadn't agreed to lie, hadn't even discussed it, but the damage was done. Or still to come, according to Tomas, and the boy would no longer volunteer with the horses, or consider Ben his friend. That hurt Benny Parks, in a way that the threat of a beating from a bully did not. He found himself crying over the next 2 days, drawing the attention of other bullies, and went off on his own to do his worrying. He'd have gone to the chapel to talk to a priest, or maybe just to the statue of La Virgen, but there were always people there, and he needed to be alone. The English-only classroom was often vacant during lunch, and Ben went in there, leafing through the few books they had, which he'd leafed through a dozen times before, and sitting in the corner where misbehaviors were seated, self-inflicting punishment. The monjas were always instructing them about honesty and integrity, and how the saints never lied, even when it meant their martyrdom, and that the boys should go and do likewise. But he wasn't so sure now. If he had lied, would he still have friends? Eugenio was upset with him, too, about the beating he'd received, and while he hadn't proclaimed their friendship dead like the younger boy, he had been cold and bitter about Ben's confession, and chose to spend his little free time with other boys. To make matters worse, Brock Lusk cornered Ben in line for food, saying he'd lost his cigarettes because the boy had squealed on him. "The next smoke I roll, I'm gonna put out on your neck." He grinned at the fearful reaction Ben showed him and said, "Maybe you're right. Haven't decided yet. But it's gonna hurt." It wasn't a hollow threat either. Ben had tried to be brave, fairly sure Brock wanted him to be scared. But this was just too much. Hermana Teresa taught singing, Spanish reading, and oversaw rebinding. She was a little too short for a grown woman, meeting most of the orphans at eye level, and the mark above her left eyebrow was a subject of much speculation among the boys. It was she who had come across Ben at his lowest point, sniffling beside the outhouse next to the bookbinding shed. She had revealed to him the good news about the lean rider's imminent visit, and it had an almost miraculous result.
"When?" Ben asked her. "He wires to say he comes on his day after next."
Ben's tears dried. This was it? The answer to his prayers? Oh, he'd done a lot of praying since the incident with the horse. He prayed to God, baby Jesus, the Pope, and La Virgen, that Tomas would be all right, that he'd forgive him and be his friend again, that he and Eugenio would be watched over, protected, that Brock Lusk would forget about him, move on to other victims, or get bitten on the dingus by a copperhead and pass from this world. Ben wasn't proud of this last prayer, but it had been heartfelt nevertheless, and he hoped the Lord would understand. And hey, there were a bunch of other prayers he could answer before that one. After his conversation with Hermana Teresa, Ben's mind was filled with new hope, new possibilities, a new thing to pray for. Life at the orphanage was too grim to expect anything like Christmas presents, but this visit was very much like one. To see Jerome Cook twice in 1 year? Ben knew it was unlikely he'd be chosen. The rider had never picked anyone under 10 before, in the nearly 20 years since he'd started the sidekick tradition. But there was no way to predict who he'd choose and why. Devin Darkey had been quick to answer the rider's questions. But heck, even Legless Motel had known the sun rose in the east and set in the west. Something had singled Devin out to Senor Cook, and Ben was determined to have that something this time. A special meeting was called with Padre Puente and all the boys. They were going to sing Las Mañanitas and Noche de Luz in welcome of the writer. Ranquewe even insisted they sing a verse in English, too, which Ben appreciated. The visit would be held out in the courtyard, if there was no rain, and in the chapel if there was. They'd all stand at attention in a semicircle near the main gates and welcome the crime fighter reverently. To hear Padre Puente say it, it was like a visit from a big brother, one who had left home years ago and made his fortune far away. To most of the boys, it was like a visit from President Cleveland, or maybe the Catholic saint the orphanage was named after. Not much happened between the announcement and the arrival of the Lean Rider. An elderly couple on their way to the West Coast stopped by, looking for someone to come with them to try his hand at planting grapes for winemaking. Rafael Alonso was the only one interested in going with them, due to the foolish idea that he might run into the mother that abandoned him somewhere in California. How he'd recognize her was anybody's guess. And then the day came. The weather was overcast and gray and nearly cold, but it wasn't raining. The entire orphanage gathered themselves together in the courtyard, arranged as they had planned, then altered and rearranged according to the padre's private tastes. Nevertheless, the rider didn't arrive until just before noon. Ben was standing in the second row, in between Claudio and Mocoso Macos, twin brothers who couldn't stand one another. Eugenio had to practically drag Tomas there, and those two sat at the very end of the first row, closest to the gates, but so far from Ben that when the excitement began to wash over them, he couldn't see what it was about. A white horse had just appeared in the distance. It was the huge mount that had been given to Senor Cook by Sarah Winchester as a reward for returning a stolen shipment of brand new rifles. It took a tall horse to carry a tall man, one supposed. But the rider was so skinny, he wouldn't be much of a burden. He wouldn't be much of a burden for a donkey. He ambled slowly and lazily onto the property, tipping his hat to the four boys who sat. Three had polio, and one had no legs. Winchester carried him regally past the group, and he stopped in the center of the circle of orphans, dismounting there as though he'd rehearsed it. The head priest and nun stood together, the rest of the staff a row behind them, and they all greeted Jerome Cook. Puente had worked there long enough to have known Cook before he was written up in newspapers and dime novels, but only two of the nuns, now elderly, had been there when Cook was an orphan boy. His eyes moved over them, and he flashed a winning smile. Two of the younger nuns blushed.
"It's so good to see you back again so soon, Jerome," Puente said, first in Spanish, then in English. "We hope that you are well, and that danger has been strange to you."
That part was only in English. Jerome Cook nodded.
"Well, Padre, danger tends to find me, even if I don't go looking for it."
That line, too, had probably been well rehearsed, but the boys ate it up nonetheless.
"Before you choose your compañero, we hope you will be breaking bread with us and let us singing to you."
Before Cook could answer, Ranquewe threw up her arms, the signal to commence the first song. The boys and the nuns sang Las Mañanitas, and the rider stood less than patiently, humming and letting his eyes pass over every boy there. When his gaze fell on Ben, the boy began singing out as hard as his vocal cords could manage. If Cook noticed, his eyes didn't linger long. After the song, Padre Puente began to recite his speech, seemingly word for word what he had said the last time, about San Domingo being a special place and the honor its favorite son did by coming back there time and again. Jerome Cook, too, was special. If he...
Padre,
Cook interrupted, raising a long-fingered hand.
I sure do hate to cut you off, but I'm doing Santa Fe day after tomorrow.
Padre Puente made that face he showed whenever a boy broke one of the myriad orphanage rules, or something deviated from his perfectly formulated plans. It was a familiar expression to most everyone there.
In español, por favor, Puente said, as though Cook were 10 instead of somewhere near 40.
Señor Cook pursed his lips, almost smiled, then said in fair Spanish that he had no time, and thanks for welcoming him.
I need a boy who can think on his own, he said, switching to English, who isn't afraid to get his hands dirty or ride in when bullets are flying.
Ben hoped he was that boy, but as far as the bullets went, he had never been tested.
How many of you can ride a horse? Cook asked,
and Madre Ranquewe translated into Spanish. Ben had ridden when he lived with his aunt and cousins, and he had been atop a horse just that week. Did it matter if the horse actually went anywhere? So he lifted his hand high. Several of the boys stepped forward, and nearly all raised their hands. Ben saw that one of those boys was bigger than the others, Brock Lusk. Cook asked a couple more questions, one about terrain, one about how many shots in a loaded pistol, one about who gets the last cup of water between you, your horse, and the lady you rescued from the Indians. Who could shoot? Who could tie a knot? Who could catch a fish without a hook or line? Who could find north on a moonless night? Ben, who should have been riveted by the writer's every word and deed, kept glancing over at Lusk. He was doing something with his hands, something Ben couldn't see from where he stood. Whatever it was obviously more important than a visit from a living legend. And a moment later, Jerome Cook noticed it too.
"The hell you doing there, boy?"
the writer asked, eliciting a little gasp from a couple of the nuns. Ben wondered if Mother Ranquewe wanted to get the whooping rod out of her office right now. Brock Lusk looked up, narrowing his eyes.
"Roland Smokes," he said.
Then almost as an afterthought, "Sir?" To everyone's surprise, Cook grinned.
"You rolled me one."
Brock only shrugged.
"Ride a horse, kid?"
Brock nodded, his attention on his work.
"You know how to shoot a gun?"
At that, Brock stopped what he was doing, held out a cigarette, and said,
"I could shoot you."
Cook chuckled. He reached in his pocket and pulled out a dollar coin.
"Here, take this." "Thanks, mister." "No, it ain't to keep. Standing where you are, I want you to throw it at Winchester. If you hit him, you're my guy." "Winchester?"
Brock asked, stupidly. Cook's good humor faded.
"That bear-sized horse. Maybe you noticed it?"
Winchester was 30 feet away, sniffing at something by the trash barrels. Its body was turned away, making a considerably smaller target, even though Ben thought he could make it if he really threw hard. Brock squinted at the horse, then back at its owner.
"Can I just keep the buck?"
"If you like." Brock considered it. He reached toward his pocket, then changed his mind, reared back, and hurled the coin like he was throwing a rock through a basilica window. Winchester started, whirled and snorted, fire in its eyes.
"It must have hurt," Ben thought.
"Must have hurt," Cook said.
He glanced over at Padre Puente, who actually averted his eyes. Ben saw Sister Teresa's expression change not far away. It was like she wanted to laugh. Ben didn't want to laugh. He didn't know how he knew it, but Ben was certain that she had given Lusk back his cigarette makings. Why? After all the hurt he'd caused and badness he'd exhibited? He couldn't say. But it had worked. Cook lifted his hand a little, those lightning-quick fingers making a point.
Son, what's your name?
Ain't nobody's son, but Brock or Brockton. Lusk's the name.
Cook smiled. Okay, Brock or Brockton Lusk, he began. I guess you're coming.
And then Padre Puente spoke up, daring to interrupt the man back, in English this time.
Señor Cook, hear me. I do not know if this boy...
And he was interrupted, amazingly, by Madre Ranquewe.
Padre, she said, I forgetting something before to tell you.
Puente frowned, glancing over, clearly displeased. Perhaps later he'd have Madre Ranquewe give Ranquewe a good thrashing.
Hermana, he began,
and Ranquewe stepped over and muttered something in his ear. Cook put up with the delay with thread-thin patience.
Politics, Ben thought he heard him say.
Ben saw Brock glare back at them, just as displeased at being interrupted. Another nun cleared her throat and said, as bravely as she dared,
We have prepared another song for you, Señor Cook. Maybe we could...
Nope. No time, he said. Albuquerque's waiting.
Ben couldn't judge his tone from where he stood, but he vaguely remembered it being Santa Fe the rider had to ride to.
There a problem, Padre? Cook asked, all but shouting.
There was a wariness to his eyes, as though sensing an ambush or a hidden rifleman somewhere along the next ridge. Puente straightened.
No, señor. I am sorry. Continue, please.
Cook studied him, the big nun, then Brock Lusk, and then whatever he was feeling, he dismissed it. He put a hand on Brock's shoulder, turning him to face the other orphans. Ben thought Brock would shake the man's arm off him, thus giving the rest of the boys a second chance. But it didn't happen.
Sorry, boys, but Mr. Lust and I have to head on down the trail.
Brock didn't correct the gunslinger, which was more admirable restraint. Cook smiled warmly at the children, his gaze briefly meeting every one.
You know, I'll probably be back this way again one day not too long from now. So study hard and do what your teachers tell you.
He glanced at Brock.
You want to say your goodbyes?
Hell no,
the boy muttered. And though it made no sense to Ben, that response got a laugh out of Jerome Cook. He tipped his hat at the oldest nuns, nodded at Padre Puente, and said,
Merry Christmas, y'all,
then headed for his horse. They began to sing Silent Night. But there was far less exuberance now than there had been with the first song. As soon as the horse was out of the way, Ben darted over to where it had been standing. He fished the silver dollar out of the dirt and started to put it in his pocket. Then he turned and spied Tomas standing next to Hermana Little. He approached. Ben held out his hand to him, and the boy took the coin from him, unable to hide his delight. All was forgiven, it appeared, and that was worth more than a dollar. Many boys cried unashamedly as Cook made his departure, briefly waiting by the main entrance to give Lusk time to go gather his things. Most of them were tears of disappointment, but for some, Ben, Eugenio, and little Tomas, they were tears of relief. The worst of the bullies was going far away, making life considerably better for practically everyone. It was a Christmas miracle. The end.
Okay, and we're back. I do hope you enjoyed that story. I was hesitant to share it, as you know, because I didn't feel like it was where it needed to be. And I still kind of don't, but that's okay. I'll just work harder on the next one. So this is the third Ben Parks story that I've written, and you have heard the first two. First was 2005, the second was 2015.
This one was 2017. And I got it into my head that maybe I would write short stories in between the novellas, in between the ones that aren't short. I still have the idea for the short story, the one that was going to originally be the sequel to Birth of a Sidekick, in my mind. And I actually started writing it in 2018, and I couldn't decide whether it would be a novella or a short story. It started out as a short story, but I felt like maybe it has enough meat that it could be longer. But because I didn't finish it, we'll never know. Now, I mean, you know, I started writing it recently enough that it's not, I don't consider that one abandoned. It's just on hold. But there is another novella that's completed. So that's three of those. And I started on a fourth novella that picks up right after A Sidekick's Journey. And in my mind, I was thinking, this one's the one that's sort of religious in nature. And I was thinking, like, sins of a sidekick, or a sidekick's penance, you know, that kind of stuff. I don't know. I didn't get far into that one at all, but I don't consider that one abandoned either. Also, a story that I started in 2018. That was, I'm not going to say that 2018 was a year that I was very... You hear that, right? I'm not going to say that 2018 was the year that I was really prolific or successful with my writing, but I did write A Sidekick, Two Miracles, and then I enjoyed that so much that I thought, well, I'll just go right into another sidekick story, and that didn't go as well. But that doesn't mean it's not successful. I just need to stay with it. I really like these Ben Parks stories. I hope you like them too. I like the decency of the character, the wide-eyed wonder of it all. And then I like the Western genre. And as I've said multiple times, even this year, I like that he doesn't age, even though I do. And yeah, even if it takes 10 years in between stories, the 10 years fly by for me, and they never even happened for the characters. Should I wait for that sound to go away, or should... Yeah? So this is, you know, a flashback story that takes place before the first one, and it's... I'm going to say it's entirely expendable. How's that? You don't have to read this story to enjoy the other stories, but I do a little bit of world building in this that will pay off in the future. The other short story that I was going to write, that's sort of a bridge between the first two novellas, is about this guy Rembrandt, who is name checked for the very first time in this story. In fact, I went in, because he was called St. Clair in the manuscript that I have on my laptop, I went in today and searched and replaced all of the examples of St. Clair, turned them to Rembrandt, which sadly cost me 20 or so words in the manuscript. And then the other thing that it sets up is Brock Lusk. And just like Lorelei Scruggs in A Sidekick's Journey, holy moly, Brock Lusk is a name. The name came first, and then the character came second. I believe I actually sent a package to a guy named Brock Lusk, and the name stayed with me because of its ugliness. I got this idea a couple years ago that the lean writer had a sidekick that went bad, and Jerome Cook ditched him because the sidekick was a little psycho. And years later, after Cook is dead, this sidekick comes looking for him, and he wants to enact vengeance on all of the sidekicks. And so that was Brock Lusk's introduction. This was his introduction, but there you go. That will be the payoff when I wrote that. Deaths of a sidekick? Goodness, I don't know. But I think that that's what we'll do. You know, I'm going to go in and I'm going to change. I'm going to get ready for the rest of my day. So that's the main achievement for this story, for Choice of a Sidekick, is that it sets up Brock Lusk and that it is a Christmas story. It's another story for Ben Park. As I said, it's not really important in the scheme of things that you have read this story, but something that's written, and I don't know. It gave me another episode, and it gave me a few more hours with Ben Parks. This was written, we were working on a Super Bowl commercial in 2017, and I believe I talked about it. I'm trying to remember what the context was, but I had a lot of time just to sit around. And so I thought, you know, I'm going to write something. And I wrote almost the whole thing at that one sitting, just waiting to be used. And, you know I talked about this because there was the dude that was sitting with us that couldn't stop complaining. He bitched about, if I had known they were going to make us clap, if I had known they were going to make us stand up and do this over and over again, I wouldn't have done this. And I was just disgusted with this guy because it was such easy work. And we got to watch LeBron James not make baskets. One of the most famous basketball players still working today. And we got paid to do it. And then, yes, we got fed. And we had hours in which to sleep or read, or in my case, to write something. And so I felt like I got more than my money's worth. They treated me right. And so I wrote that then, and it didn't go anywhere. But here it is. Now you're hearing it. And I hope that you liked it or liked something about it or like the prospect of more. I'll say a couple of words about the holiday season. As I said, people seemed nice out there in Chicago, even though it's really cold and there's a lot more people than I'm used to. I'm just a country boy, I guess. But maybe it is the holiday season. There's lights everywhere and there are people that seem to be shopping for presents, that sort of thing. And I had a couple of folks say happy holidays to me. I can't complain about that. That's pretty neat. Right now I'm at the window. I'm looking out at all these lighted office buildings. If I squint really hard, I can see people, but it's mostly just buildings. And I'm lucky that I could be here in the Windy City for the first time and experience this. You know, I'm lucky that I have so many opportunities. Opportunities to fail in my case, but there's still opportunities. I'm happy to have an audience as small as it is. I'm happy that I have podcasting partners in Marshall and Big that are willing to get together with me and create, if not art, content at least, and maintain friendship that way. And I thank you for listening. I thank you, especially if you are a Patreon supporter or have made donations to me or to the Doonstief or to me or to Marshall over at his Patreon or to me. Thank you. You keep me going. You keep it going. Like I said, I don't have a tremendous amount of time between now and Christmas, but I'm willing to put in the time because of you. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. You know, if you don't celebrate Christmas, enjoy winter solstice, enjoy December and the new year. Everybody should celebrate the new year. Oh, people, Chinese people have a different new year. Well, dang it. Why do you have to ruin? I'm trying to say something nice here. Thank you. and good night.
Y'all.
The music in the show was by Kevin MacLeod over at incompetech.com.
I cannot believe it has come to this. The Rish Outcast has always been presented under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial License. And yet look at what you've done with it. It was not to be sold, not to be hacked apart, and not to be claimed by anyone except the original benighted podcaster. You might have gone so far, even to supporting young Outfield with his foolhardy Patreon account schemes. But no, I trusted you, loved you, and how have you betrayed me?
Lately, I've been thinking, I want you to be happier, I want you to be happier. But only for a minute, I want to change my mind. Just don't feel right to me.
For little Benny Parks, her English was better than a lot of the sisters.
Soon is coming
the envy of everyone, even the monk.
God!
But he understood special a gunslinger would look for, or even knew how, more even than getting adopted by some rancher or well-to-do family.
Exciting.
I need to make the text bigger. Why would I have it just regular size?
Idiot.
Even though it was, he'd hugged the big gray animal around the neck, or consider Ben his friend. Eugenio was upset with him too, and Ben went in there. And Ben went in there. There was even a wall right outside the orphanage. Ben was asked to leap in a small but audible voice.
F*** you. We hope you will be breaking.
As though Cook were 10 instead of. Or that Brock Lusk had anything. Or that Brock Lusk had had. Or that Brock Lusk had had anything.
F***ing.
He found himself crying over the next 2 days. And those two sat at the very end of the first.
The next smoke I roll, I'm going to put out on your neck. I'm going to put out on your neck.
It took a tall horse to... It took a tall horse to carry a tall man, one supposed. But there was no way to predict who he'd choose and why. Devin Darkey had been quick to answer the writer's questions. But heck, even the legless boy had known the sun rose in the east and set in the west. I have to fix all the senors because I wrote it. I must have written it on this thing. And there was no enye. Something had singled Devin out to Senor Cook. And Ben was determined to have that something this time.
Sarah Winchester, I love it.
I thought it would be fun to have fake Sean sing Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. Let's see how that goes.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas, and let your heart be light. From now on, our troubles will be out of sight. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Make the Yuletide gay. From now on, our troubles will be miles away. Here we are, as in olden days, happy golden days of yore. Faithful friends, who are dear to us, gather near to us once more. Through the years, we all will be together, if the fates allow. Hang a shining star upon the highest bough, and have yourself a merry little Christmas now. Have yourself a merry little Christmas, let your heart be light. Next year all our troubles will be out of sight. Have yourself a merry little Christmas, make the Yuletide gay. Next year, all our troubles will be miles away. Once again, as in olden days, happy golden days of yore. Faithful friends who are dear to us will be near to us once more. Someday soon we all will be together, if the fates allow. Until then we'll have to muddle through somehow. So have yourself a merry little Christmas now.
I remember reading somewhere that the original version of the song, well, I mean, obviously it was much more morbid, but I feel like it was about death. Am I crazy for thinking that? The Judy Garland version that was the original, the muddle through somehow version, you know, someday soon we all will be together. You know, a year from now, our troubles will be miles away. I don't know. Okay, so it used to start out with, have yourself a merry little Christmas, it may be your last. I know, that sounds like horseshit, but next year we may all be living in the past. It just seems very dark. And I remember the first time I ever heard the Until Then We'll Have to Muddle Through Somehow version, and that was, it was on ER. Rosemary Clooney sang it. And I just thought that was so strange. Until Then We'll Have to Muddle Through Somehow. I had always heard it, hang a shining star upon the highest bough. And for some reason, the muddle through somehow spoke to me of just, hey, sometimes all of this holiday cheer is overblown and a bit unrealistic, and the best that you can hope for is to muddle through somehow. Well, this is it for 2019 for the Rish Outcast, and I'm kind of astounded. I was so sure that real Sean Connery was not going to make it, that he would die, and I recorded a couple of songs one in 2018 and one in 2019 in anticipation of that day. And it didn't come. And I look, I'm happy that he's still around, but we don't get to enjoy him anymore. I didn't mean to end this episode on such a down note. Have a great holiday season and an especially great new year. Good night.